honestly, it took a good year, year and a half, maybe 2 years before we really got to the point where we felt like the business was sort of on autopilot. But by 2010, 2011, when my second son was born, we were flipping 25, 30 houses a year in about 5 to 10 hours a week. So it took a lot of work. It took a lot of experimenting. It took a lot of effort, but eventually we figured out really how to systematize this business. And that's kind of been our entire strategy around everything we've done. I mean, we do a lot of different investing things these days, but everything we do, kind of, we go in with the attitude of how can we systematize this? How can we create processes and methodologies that allow us to accomplish as much as possible in a short amount of time as possible.
Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it. Are you ready to start investing in real estate today but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend, Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy-to-understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars to claim your free course today. Hey, welcome back to Pillars of Wealth Creation. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. With me today, I'm excited to have Jay Scott. Jay, how are you doing?
Great. How's it going, Todd?
Doing very, very well. I appreciate you being on the show. A little bit about Jay is he's a full-time entrepreneur and investor. He's living in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and Jay is an engineer and business guy by education. He spent much of his career, early part of his career, in Silicon Valley, where he held management positions in several Fortune 500 companies. You might be familiar with Microsoft and eBay. He was a part of those. In 2008, he and his wife decided they're going to leave their corporate, 80-hour per week job, constant business travel, and they're just going to try something new. So that ended up being real estate. And in the past 9 years, they've bought, built, rehabbed, sold, done lending, and held over $40 million in different properties. And Jay also runs the popular website 123flip.com. He's the author of 3 books on real estate investing. The best-selling book, The Book on Flipping Houses, that's the title, The Book on Flipping Houses, is the best-selling book. And his books have sold over 100,000 copies in the past 5 years and helped tons of investors from all around the world get their start in real estate. So with that said, Jay, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what your business is all about, what makes you tick?
Absolutely. So like you mentioned, and I appreciate that introduction, I was an engineer out of college, got my MBA back in the early 2000s when I was in California, did the big corporate thing for a long time. And my wife and I met in 2006. We were both working kind of ridiculous hours. She was traveling most of the month every month. I was traveling a couple weeks every month. So when we decided to get married and start a family, we kind of realized pretty quickly that that lifestyle, never seeing each other, working all the time, just wasn't conducive to starting a family. So in 2008, when we finally set a wedding date, we sat down and we said, hey, let's figure out what we're going to do about this. Is one of us going to quit our job and the other one going to raise the family? Are we going to cut our hours back, get different jobs? What are we going to do? And ultimately what we both decided and agreed on, and it was great because we had very similar goals, is that we wanted to put family first. We wanted to basically put our life over work. So back in 2008, we quit our jobs in California. We moved back east to get a little bit closer to where we grew up. And we decided we're going to start some type of what we called at the time, and I guess I don't know if this term was around back then, but what's commonly now called a lifestyle business. So basically a business that would allow us to prioritize family and our life and the stuff we enjoy doing over work and the stuff we have to be doing. So 2008, we moved from California to the East Coast, and we sort of fall into real estate. One day we're sitting on the couch, we're still trying to figure out what that lifestyle business is going to be, and I'm flipping through the TV stations, and a house flipping show comes on, which if anybody was watching TV back in 2008, that was pretty much the only thing that was on TV. And my wife says, hey, while we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with our lives, why don't we flip a house? Let's do something fun. And I thought she was joking. I mean, anybody that knows me knows that I can barely change a light bulb. But I said, okay, if you want to give it a try, let's give it a try. And spent a couple months learning about buying and selling houses, how to rehab houses a little bit. And actually, the day we got married, August 8th, 2008, we bought our first investment property, our first flip property. And I don't quite know how it happened, but one turned into two, turned into three. And before we knew it, we had done 15 flips in our first year. We did something like 25 or 30 our second year, and we just kind of kept going from there. So little did we realize it, but real estate ended up being that lifestyle business that we were looking to start, and we just kept rolling from there.
So with so many flips, I mean, you're doing 15, you're doing 25. I've been there and done that. I know that's a lot of work. What did you do to have a lifestyle business and yet be able to do 15 to 20 flips, or did it become a job?
Yeah, and that's actually funny because I talk about a lifestyle business. I made my wife a promise when we first moved that when we had kids, I made her a couple promises. One, she could be a stay-at-home mom. I mean, she had worked hard for 15 years. I mean, she was literally doing the corporate jet thing for 10 years at eBay. And so she had worked hard and she was just ready to take a break. And she just wanted to focus on raising the kids and being the stay-at-home mom. So I promised her she could do that. I also promised her that I would never miss a baseball game. I'd never miss a piano recital. I'd never miss this or that. Basically that I would always be there and I'd always be able to put family over business. Well, after the first year, our first son was born on September 22nd, 2009. So just about a year and a couple months after we got married. And like I mentioned, we'd done 15 flips our first year. I was back to working about 80 hours a week. My wife was working a good 40, 50, 60 hours a week helping the business. So when our son was born, she kind of looked at me and she said, you know, this has to change. And I was enjoying real estate. We were making good money at it. But I had made her a promise and I said, okay, I'll figure out how to make a change. And the first thing I thought was, okay, we're going to scale back. Instead of doing 15 houses a year, we'll do 5 or 10 houses a year. I figure if I'm working 60 hours a week doing 15, I'll work 20 or 40 hours a week doing 5 or 10. But what I quickly realized was I actually was really enjoying growing this business. So sat down with a mentor of mine, a guy that I had worked with for a long time. And I was like, hey, can you help me out here? Like, what do I do? And he pointed out that you don't just have to scale back your business. If you optimize your business, if you build good, solid processes and methodologies around the business, there's no reason why we couldn't be doing 15, 20, 30 flips a year, but in a whole lot less time. So at that point, my goal was kind of to figure out how to hack the real estate business, the flipping business, and figure out how I could keep doing 15, 20, 25, 30 deals a year, but be working less than 40 hours a week and optimally be working less than 20 hours a week. And honestly, it took a good year, year and a half, maybe 2 years before we really got to the point where we felt like the business was sort of on autopilot. But by 2010, 2011, when my second son was born, we were flipping 25, 30 houses a year in about 5 to 10 hours a week. So it took a lot of work. It took a lot of experimenting. It took a lot of effort, but eventually we figured out really how to systematize this business. And that's kind of been our entire strategy around everything we've done. I mean, we do a lot of different investing things these days, but everything we do kind of, we go in with the attitude of how can we systematize this? How can we create processes and methodologies that allow us to accomplish as much as possible in a short amount of time as possible.
So can you give us a few key tips? What did you do in order to do that? Because anybody who's done flipping, and I'm sure there's plenty of listeners that have done flipping, I've done flipping, it's definitely time consuming. And getting those systems in place is important if you want to scale, which, you know, I was able to scale, but not to the point where I was only working, you know, small amount of time to do that many flips. I was still putting in a lot of time. So to tell us, give us a couple tips. What did you do?
Absolutely. And to use the terminology to fit with the theme of the show, I can probably talk about kind of the six pillars of optimizing and scaling. And this has been, we originally did this with our real estate business, but we found that this kind of works in any kind of any business that we're starting and we're running. But the first thing we'd like to do is we segment the business. We kind of figure out what are the key components of the business? How does it naturally break down? And to do this, I mean, literally, if we go into a new business, I'll take a five books of post-it notes, and I'll write down literally every task on a different post-it note that the business entails. And so for like in the real estate business, it was everything from making offers to calling contractors, to managing contractors, to making budgets, to creating schedules, to getting inspections, getting appraisals. I mean, literally, you can think of thousands of little tasks that go into a real estate business, and then group those tasks. And so for real estate, what we ultimately found was our business broke down into four really clear, really clean segments. And that was acquisition, so finding properties, doing renovations, selling properties, so the disbursement of properties, and then raising money. And basically any task in our entire flipping business would fit into one of those groups. And again, that's acquisition, renovations, disbursement, and raising money. So once we had those segments, we could really focus on how to optimize each segment. We can treat each segment as kind of its own business, its own piece of the company. And if you think about it, this is exactly what large businesses do. I mean, I worked at Microsoft for a long time, and you go to any large tech company and you're going to have one group that's focused on writing code. You're going to have another group that's focused on defining the product. You're going to have a marketing group. You're going to have a sales group. You're going to have a documentation group, customer service group, Q&A and test group. I mean, basically, this is the way large businesses are broken down. They segment their business into its key components, and then they hire people to to come in and kind of manage each of these pieces of the business. So segmentation was number one. Number two was what I just mentioned, delegation or hiring people. So once we realized that we had four components of our business, four key components of our business, the question was, how could we get a lot of the stuff that was involved in each of those four key components off of our plates? And so for acquisitions, there was this natural synergy between real estate agents and doing all of our acquisition tasks. So we knew that if we could bring on a real estate agent, we could bring on a good marketing person, that would allow us to kind of offload a lot of that first piece of the puzzle, which was acquisitions. On the construction and renovation side, we knew that if we hired a really good project manager or construction manager, basically, we could offload pretty much everything from the renovation side of things. We could offload the creating scopes of work. We could offload the creating budgets, creating schedules, hiring contractors, managing contractors, overseeing quality, all of that stuff. So the next thing we did was we hired a really good construction manager and let him kind of run with that piece. Third, on the disbursement side, again, that's the marketing and sale of properties. So my wife was really good at that. So she did some of that, but we also found a really good real estate agent that could market out and knew the area really well and could sell properties. And then on the raising money piece, that was kind of something that was hard to farm out. So I continued to do a lot of the raising money thing. So the second piece of the puzzle was kind of the delegation thing. Now, the problem with the delegation thing was we found that if we had to bring in a new construction manager, for example, when we expanded the business, or if we had to bring in a new real estate agent, or we had to bring in a new marketing person, we found ourselves spending a ridiculous amount of time training these people. Like literally, we went through a couple construction managers in the first 6 months. I'd spend 2 months training them. And then they'd leave in the third month. And so 2/3 of the time was wasted time on my part where I wasn't getting any savings. I was actually spending a lot of extra time doing all this training. So the third thing that we really instituted was documentation in our business. So, we made sure that for every little task in our business, we documented exactly what needed to be done, how it was going to be done. We created checklists. We created process documents, basically enough documentation so that if I hired a new construction manager, I could hand them our book of construction processes, and they could read through that, and they had the checklist, they had the detailed outline of what they were supposed to be doing day in and day out, and how they could verify that the work they were doing was up to the quality that we expected. So by implementing this documentation piece in the business, we were really able to extract our time from having to do training, from having to do things like if one of our employees went on vacation for a week, instead of having to either do it ourselves because nobody else knew how to do it or quickly training somebody else to take over for them, we could just hand them this binder of documentation and say, hey, go do it yourself. We could hand it to somebody else on the team and have them go do it themselves. So again, segmentation was the first piece, delegation was the second piece, documentation was the third piece. The fourth thing that we did, and this was tremendously helpful, we focused on replication of every part of our business. So again, we talk about the four pieces of our business, acquisition, renovation, marketing and selling, and raising capital. In each of those areas, we asked ourselves the question, how can we replicate tasks within each of these areas? So for example, in the renovation space, what we realized was, there was no reason for my wife to go into every property and say, okay, what cabinets are we going to use in this house? And what flooring are we going to use? And what light fixtures are we going to use? No, instead we said, hey, there's no reason why we can't use the same cabinets. We can't use the same tile. We can't use the same flooring. We can't use the same light fixtures, the same appliances, the same everything. Go out, buy that stuff in bulk, make a list of the SKUs so that when our let's say our painters come in, our painters never have to say, what color are we painting this house? They know that we paint every house the same exact color. And so they can go out and they can buy 200 gallons of that paint as opposed to having to buy 5 gallons or 10 gallons at a time. They don't have to worry about asking us what color they're supposed to be painting this house because it's the same as the last 10 houses they painted. We use the same vendors, the same materials. On the acquisition side, literally we created one contract, and the only thing we ever had to change in the contract when we made an offer was the address, the date, the amount we were willing to pay, and the closing date. But other than that, the contract was the same for every house. We used the same contingencies. We had a closing attorney that we worked with a lot, and we said, hey, because a lot of times getting scheduled with the closing attorney took a lot of time. So we said, hey, keep every Tuesday open for our business. Just give us the morning every Tuesday. And we were giving them enough business that they were happy to just block out 3 hours every Tuesday morning. So when we made an offer or we were going to sell or buy a house, we basically talked to the other party and say, hey, we close on Tuesday mornings. So you tell us the next Tuesday, the following Tuesday, or the Tuesday after works for you. And we already had the time on the calendar. So we only had to go to the closing attorney's office once a week. On the marketing side, we use the same photographer every time. We use the same staging furniture. I mean, the benefit of using the same staging furniture in every house is if you can't get a good picture of a living room in one house, we did 20 other houses this year. I bet you we have another living room that looks similar enough that people won't even notice when they get in the house. And so basically replication allowed us to scale up our business, and do the exact same thing we were doing, but instead of having to spend 10 houses worth of time, to do all this stuff, we could do it in one house worth of time. So replication was the next big thing. Next thing we talk about is, all these things kind of have a theme, they end with shun, expectation. So expectation was a big thing. I talked to a lot of investors and I say to them, what are your goals? And they don't have goals. They don't know if next year they want to do one property or 10 properties. They say they want to make $1 million next year. And I say, okay, well, how are you going to get there? And they're like, I don't know. I'm going to do a bunch of work and hopefully I get to $1 million. And I say, well, that's not really going to work. I mean, you need to figure out what you need to do to accomplish your goals. And so I'll say, what's your average profit per flip? And they'll say, I make an average of $20,000 per flip. Okay, you want to make $1 million next year? The math's pretty easy. You have to do 50 flips. And they say, oh, okay, that makes sense. And I say, okay, how many weeks in a year? 50 weeks in a year. You need to be buying one house a week for the next 50 weeks if you want to hit $1 million. And you start putting the numbers behind these things. Okay, so if I want to do one house a week, how many letters am I going to have to send out to potential sellers to get one house a week? Well, I don't know. How many purchases do you make every 1,000 letters you send? You know, I have to send out about 2,500 letters to get a deal, if they're using letter marketing. So I say, okay, well, now you know you need to be sending out 2,500 letters a week if you want to get one deal a week, if you want to do 50 deals a year, if you want to make $1 million. Oh, okay, so 2,500 letters a week. I was only sending 2,000 letters a month. Well, now you know if you want to make $1 million next year, you need to send out 2,500 letters a week. And so you start working through these numbers and you work backwards and you realize that if your goal is to make a certain amount of money, the steps to make that amount of money are actually pretty clear. You just have to think about it and you have to work backwards. And so we kind of did the same thing. We said, and for me, it wasn't so much, I want to make $1 million a year. For me, it was, I didn't want to work more than 10 hours a week. So I work backwards. Okay, where is my time going? How much time am I spending on each of the four quadrants of the business, the acquisition, the rehab, the selling, and the money raising? Where am I spending my time? And how can I kind of quantify my time so that I can get as much done in 10 hours as opposed to focusing on I want to flip 30 houses or I want to make $1 million. No, the thing that was important to me was the time. So that's what I focused on creating expectations around. And then the last piece I talk about is prioritization. And this to me is the simplest one in some respects, but the hardest for a lot of people out there. I had a friend of mine. So in the first year or so that I was trying to do this, I was having tough time really cutting my hours back to where I wanted them to be. And one day I get a call from, I'm hanging out with a friend of mine for lunch. I get a call from a contractor who says, hey, we're short on some some supplies. I think it was like a box of screws or a couple boxes of screws or something. Do you want me to go to Home Depot and grab those? Or do you want to have your project manager grab them? Or do you want to grab them and drop them off to me? I'm like, I'm getting ready to finish up lunch. I'll stop by Home Depot. I'll take them over to you. I'll have them there in about a half hour, 45 minutes. He's like, great. Hang up the phone and I'm talking to my friend and he's like, what was that? And I said, oh, after this, I'd have to run to Home Depot and whatever. He's like, 10 minutes ago, you were complaining to me that you didn't have enough time to do what you wanted. You weren't able to like cut your hours back. And now you're telling me you're like getting up and you're going to go to Home Depot to pick up a box of screws for your contractor. He's like, is that really the best use of your time? And I'm like, well, if you think about it, I mean, if I call Home Depot and I order a box of screws, it's going to cost me $60 for them to drop it off. If my project manager goes, he's going to have to leave the work site for an hour and things are going to slow down. And so I'm going to lose money there. If my contractor goes, all his guys are going to take a break while he's gone and they're not going to get any work done. So it's going to cost us money if anybody else does this besides me. And he said, well, you said money isn't your highest priority. You said time is your highest priority. And a light bulb just kind of went off in my head. And he was right. I mean, all this time I kept talking about all I care about is my time. All I care about is my time. All I care about is my time. But then when it comes down to it, I'm putting money over time by driving to Home Depot, picking up a $2 box of screws and dropping them off at the construction site. And so from that day forward, I kept every time I had to make a decision, every time I had to decide what I was going to do, I asked myself the question, is this really worth the money I'm going to save by spending the time? So I kind of set an hourly rate for when it's worth spending the time to do something. And I kind of came up with the number $500 an hour. And from that moment on, I never did anything unless it was literally going to save me $500 an hour. And so in that case, I mean, calling Home Depot and saying, hey, I'm going to spend $60 to have you deliver that $2 box of screws, that's worth it for me because I'm not making $500 an hour by going and delivering that box of screws myself. So at that point, I learned that if time is the most important thing to me, I need to make decisions that prioritize time. For other people, money might be the big thing, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. If somebody says money is more important than time, then absolutely go to Home Depot, pick up the screws and drop them off yourself. But figure out what's important to you and then make decisions that optimize around that thing that you've decided is most important to you. Really prioritize whatever is most important to you. Don't just talk it, but live it. So those are kind of the six things that we've done in our business. And if I can remember them, they were you segment your big business, you delegate tasks, you document, you replicate tasks as much as possible, you set clear expectations for you and your employees, and then you prioritize. And so those six things are kind of the six pillars of how we've taken our business and we've gone from doing 30 flips a year in 60 hours a week to 30 flips a year in 5 to 10 hours a week. And it's changed my life.
You're bringing back so many memories for me because I went through the flipping and I was doing that a lot. And we were doing a lot of flips a year, about as many as what you were doing. Maybe at times even more. I'm sure you at times you did more too, but the Home Depot story too, it's like hilarious because that's exactly what I would do. Like for a while there, I had a Nissan Altima and I would load the thing. I remember driving to one of my job sites and I had, I don't know how many bags, probably 8 to 10 bags of 80 pound, you know, the concrete mix.
Yep.
I had 2x4s loaded in there. I had all kinds of stuff. And I went over a railroad track bed and my car just went boom.
Yep.
And all of a sudden it's like dragging on the ground. I blew out the back shocks because I had so much. I think it was unreal.
And that's part of it. I mean, I remember back like the second or third year, and we owned two cars. We had like a 15-year-old Nissan Pathfinder, which was like my crap car that I would haul around stuff in, and I didn't mind if like it got destroyed. And then we had a BMW X5, which was kind of our family car for our kids and stuff. And I'd go to a job site, and I'd hop in the BMW, and my wife would say, "What are you taking that car for? You're going to the job site." I'm like, "If I take this car, yeah, I know for a fact that I'm not going to start throwing materials in there. I'm not going to stop at Home Depot. If I take the other car, who knows what I might do. But if I take this car, I know I'm not going to get like bogged down in doing any of the construction stuff because I don't want to mess up the car." And so it was kind of a forcing function for me not to like get bogged down in those tasks that I knew I shouldn't be getting bogged down in.
Yep. Yep. And that's something that I struggled with because I needed a new vehicle and I went and bought a truck, but I knew like there's no way I'm going to continue to go to Home Depot,
yep,
and do these stupid runs because it's not worth my time. And I can't get things done. I can't buy more houses if I'm just sitting there running to Home Depot with these guys. And what I ended up doing is I told my guys that I'm only paying them for one trip to Home Depot every other day. And that's it. If they have to go again, that's on their time.
Yep.
I'm not paying them for that. I'll pay them for one trip every other day to Home Depot. They have to plan. And it worked.
And I tell my guys, I don't want you ever going to Home Depot. Give me 24 hours notice what you need. And I've got a guy at Home Depot that works at the contractor desk. I have his fax number. And if I need something, basically I tell my guys, give me 24 hours notice. I'll fax into Home Depot what we need. My contractor guy will call my project manager and say, "Here's the cost." My project manager will give him the credit card over the phone and the address. And the next morning it's getting delivered.
Yep.
And yeah, it's $60, but let me tell you something. Having my contractors walk off the job for an hour or 2 hours to go to Home Depot is going to cost me more than $60. Yeah.
And anytime you have to have that distraction like that for your contractors, for anybody that's working in the business, maybe it only takes them an hour and you go, "Oh, that's only whatever." Maybe if you pay them $30 an hour.
Yep.
But it's more than that. It's more than that hour. It's more like 2 hours because of the distraction that it's causing.
Absolutely. And telling my contractors, "Hey, Home Depot truck's going to be there at 7:30 tomorrow morning. Make sure you're there to unload the stuff." And I can make sure my contractors are working at a reasonable hour. So it's got a lot of benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was awesome. I appreciate you sharing those pillars. Like I said, brought back definitely a lot of memories on the flipping business that I was doing too. Hey, I want to interrupt this episode real quick to talk to you about Nate Armstrong, our sponsor. Nate Armstrong, he's with homeinvest.com, and you want to get to know Nate. So go to homeinvest.com and just connect with Nate, talk to him, learn about his operation, what he's got going on. He's a turnkey provider, and it may not be right for you, but it could be the perfect fit. So it doesn't hurt. It's a free call, free consultation, just to figure out, you know, what they do, what they have to offer. And worst case is you're going to meet a great person who's really well educated in real estate. He's done a ton of different real estate strategies, and probably he's going to teach you a little bit, even on a short conversation with him. So go to homeinvest.com and connect with Nate's company. You're definitely not going to be disappointed. It's worth it. So thanks. And we'll get back to our show. What's kind of a big mistake that you've made, and how did you learn and grow from it?
Oh, we've made so many mistakes. Wow. I can't pick out just one. And that's actually the thing that we are really good about. So I started a website, 123flip.com, 10 years ago when we started, and I don't sell anything on it, so I'm not pushing anything here. I started that website before we ever did our first deal. And the goal there was kind of to lay out what our plan was and to kind of hold myself accountable for everything that we were doing, and basically put out, "Hey, we're doing this, and now whoever's reading it, 100 people or 200 people now know that we're doing it. We actually have to do it." And the website, it grew tremendously very quickly. And I used that site basically to document all of our successes, one, not that there were many at the beginning, but basically all of our failures, everything we did wrong. And basically my goal was always, I don't mind, and this is kind of a rule that I live by, I don't mind making mistakes. I love making mistakes as long as I never make the same mistake twice. Mm-hmm. And documenting everything we're doing, having the website really allowed me to capture all those mistakes. It forced me to think about them. If something went wrong, instead of just thinking, hey, this didn't work, if I'm going to write about it, I'm actually going to sit there and think about why didn't this work, and let me dig in a little bit more. It really forced me to hold myself accountable for the mistakes we were making, and also to ensure that we weren't making the same mistakes twice. One of the biggest things that sticks out in my mind, and this has been a kind of core principle in our business between my wife and I, and we kind of instill this in all of our employees, there was this one deal where we got a house under contract. This was back in 2009 or 10 or 11, somewhere back there, back when the market was still tough and money was tight and buyers were having a tough time getting loans. And we had this house under contract. The buyer had a lender. Lender told us they could close on whatever day it was. And a couple days before closing, we called the lender to find out what the deal is. Oh, everything's good. We'll be good for closing. Day before closing, the title company doesn't get the lender's package. So I called the lender to find out, hey, are you sending the package over for the buyer so we can close tomorrow? No answer from the lender. Doesn't call me back. Next morning, which is the day of closing, call the lender, doesn't answer, doesn't call me back. Call the buyer. Buyer says, oh, I can't get in touch with my lender. 3 days goes by, and basically we can't get in touch with the lender. Finally, the lender calls us like 3 days after closing. We're getting ready to cancel the contract because we can't get in touch with the lender. And they're like, oh, yeah, there's this little problem with the loan. I'm working on it. We'll be good by next week. And so, well, we didn't know anything at this point. So we're just like, okay, great, next week. So we reschedule the closing. Next week comes, lender stops answering calls again. Lender finally calls us back and says, yeah, I'm working through it. We'll definitely get it done. But I'm going to need another week or two. So we extend the contract another 2 weeks. We have another closing. Ultimately, we extended the contract 2 months. And this buyer was never able to close because there was some major issue. I don't remember exactly what it was, but some major issue with their credit. They had an open lien that they never paid off, or they had a bankruptcy. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something that, had we known that up front, I mean, we never would have accepted the contract. There was no way they were ever going to get this loan. And I remember complaining to a friend of mine, somebody that I had worked with in the tech world where basically you don't make excuses like this. And I was like, yeah, the lender screwed me. The buyer screwed me. Everybody screwed us over on this deal, blah, blah. And he just looked at me and he was like, what are you talking about? You screwed up. You could have found out like at the very beginning, all you had to do was to ask for the loan conditions. So before a loan is approved, the underwriter has to provide a list of problems with the borrower that need to be fixed before the loan is approved. And the lender generally gets this a week before closing, at least. He's like, you could have asked for that underwriter loan sheet a week before. You could have told the borrower that he had to go to a different lender. You could have had him put down more earnest money. You could have had him basically put down a non-refundable deposit. There's a dozen things you could have done that would have protected yourself or that would have kept you from really running into this situation. Instead of blaming everybody else and like asking for pity, take responsibility and figure out what you did wrong so that next time you don't do that and you don't get yourself in this situation. And again, that was another one of those light bulb moments for me where he's right. I mean, it's nice to be able to blame other people when something doesn't go your way. But ultimately, while that might make you feel good for 5 minutes blaming somebody else, you're dealing with a situation that's really screwed you over. And for us, we had lost a lot of time. We had lost a lot of money. And it would have been better, instead of playing the pity card. If we would have just done things at the beginning to have mitigated any risks we had, to have anticipated any risks we had. And so from that day forward, our attitude changed to anything that happens in our business, absolutely anything that happens in our business is our fault. And it's our job to anticipate what can go wrong and to either avoid it or put in place something that will allow us to mitigate it. So we, for example, in that situation, we came up with a list of rules for closing. And basically it's, we require a minimum earnest money deposit. That money goes hard, which means it's non-refundable at some point before closing. If somebody needs an extension for their closing, they have to put down more non-refundable money. And so basically it, we can't ever avoid the problem of a buyer may not get his loan. But if a buyer doesn't get their loan now, we're going to be compensated for it. They will have put down some non-refundable amount of money or some other thing that will allow us to kind of mitigate the risk that we face with the borrower not getting their loan. And so basically that mistake with that lender and that particular deal, it really kind of changed everything in our business and forced us to start thinking about, hey, let's pretend in every situation that everything's going to go wrong. What will we do differently if that were the case? And then actually planning for things to go wrong and creating, mitigating what could possibly go wrong in the business. So that was a big thing for us. So when you ask about what was the biggest problem, that was probably the biggest problem. But it also resulted in a very much change in our thinking and a change in our business for the better.
You know, I like what you said at the beginning a lot. You talked about documenting your mistakes. You've got this 123flip.com where you documented not only successes, but failures too. I think that's really valuable for anybody that's listening, is to document mistakes. That's something that I'm going to start doing now that I heard you talk about that. I've never heard anybody say that before. You always hear, learn from your mistakes. Don't be afraid to make them. Well, that's all true. But actually writing them down is going to really get you to think about them and hopefully then come up with processes to, you're never going to avoid mistakes, but to try not to make that same mistake again and to figure out how to improve.
Absolutely. I love talking about my failures because, I mean, anybody that says they haven't failed, first of all, they're lying to you. Yeah. But when you can admit that you failed and when you can really analyze your failures, all you're doing is you're preparing yourself for the next time you go out to do the same thing. And so every time I fail, I kind of look at it's a badge of honor. It's okay, I stumbled and I'm not going to make those same mistakes next time. I started a tech business with my friend a couple years ago, and we lost $100,000. And to me, that's like it sucks that we lost $100,000. In some ways, it makes me sick that we lost $100,000. But I'll scream it from the rooftops. We failed. We made a lot of mistakes. But let me tell you something. The next time I start a business like that, it's has a lot more chance of succeeding because every mistake we made in that business, we're never going to make again. And so to me, that $100,000 failure was really, it was $100,000 education. If I don't recognize it, if I don't analyze it, if I don't think about it, if I don't tell people about it, it's basically $100,000 that I'm just hiding and getting no benefit from. But instead I'm getting a lot of benefit from it. I learned from it. It's 4 years in college, essentially, type of education. So failures are a good thing. And I think there's way too much stigma these days, especially for entrepreneurs. I mean, a lot of entrepreneurs, their friends, their family are not entrepreneurs. They're 9-to-5 type people. And for us as entrepreneurs, we feel like if we make a mistake, if we fail in one thing, it kind of makes us failures as entrepreneurs because we think we're being judged by those people that don't understand what it's like to work for yourself. But I think a lot of us have to, it was really hard, but I eventually was able to get past that. And I can say to my family, I can say to my friends that work the 9-to-5 jobs, yeah, I fail at a whole lot of things and there's nothing wrong with it. And so I think it's important for all entrepreneurs to be able to really embrace their failures and not be ashamed of them and to be able to talk about them and think about them and learn from them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. And that $100,000 failure, you know, if you learn from that, a lot of people, what I think ends up happening is they don't learn from their failures. They don't actually think about, they just kind of want to push them under the rug, and they might not have $100,000 failure, but they're going to have a lot of, you know, $500 failures and $1,000 yep. failures and maybe a couple bigger ones. And eventually that's going to add up.
Absolutely.
And if you're not learning from them, and all of a sudden you now if you really, truly add it all up, and then opportunity cost too, I mean, it adds up. So
learning from them is huge. Yeah. I talk about the fact that, we've done 200 or 300 flips at this point, and there are mistakes we've made like on the first 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 of them that I look back and I think, wow, I could have saved $500 on every flip if I had done something different, or $1,000. Mm-hmm. We could have earned an extra $1,000 on every flip. And you think about it in that context, okay, $500, big deal. I made 20,000 profit. What's $21,000? But you think of it in aggregate, you think about, I've done 200 flips. If I could have earned an extra $1,000 or saved an extra $1,000 on every flip, that's $200,000. I mean, there's college for my kids. There's the down payment on a vacation property, whatever. It like you said, it adds up, and people don't think about the little things, and they don't think about the fact that those little things really, they do add up over time.
Yep. Absolutely. So Jay, where's your business kind of heading? What are you're doing flips. What else are you doing, and where's it heading?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of, I think I've already kind of expressed that I'm a fan of not working a whole lot of hours. But I'm also a big fan of doing things that I really, really like. So for me, I kind of look at what I do as kind of where's the intersection of what I love and what I can make money at. And for a lot of us, there is that intersection. It may not be a big intersection, but there's an intersection. So I like to ask myself at all times, where is that intersection, and what things can I kind of pick out, from there that I can do stuff that I love and I can make money at. And so in addition to real estate, I do a lot of other things. I love teaching. So I've done a lot of writing over the past couple of years. I published 3 books. I'm working on my 4th. And that was one of those things that first book I wrote, I didn't do it to make money. I did it because I thought, hey, I'd love to write a book. I enjoy teaching. I like writing. And I found that, hey, I can make money from writing. Wow, this is awesome. So I'm doing more writing. I do a lot of investing in areas outside of real estate. I do some angel investing in the tech world. So I invest in some tech businesses. I love horses. So last year I started buying racehorses. Again, it's kind of that intersection of what I love and what I hope I can make money off of. And what I found is stuff like investing in racehorses or investing in anything. There are a lot of nuances that take a lot of study and a lot of work and obviously some luck as well. But I found, hey, I think I can make money owning racehorses, and I enjoy doing that. So we actually own 8 racehorses now.
How many?
8.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. It started out as one with a friend of mine who's owned horses for a long time. I was like, okay, I'll buy one with you. And it was just like with the houses, where it's like, we're going to buy one and see how it goes. And, yeah. and before we knew it, one turned into 2, into 4. And yeah, we're up to 8 now.
So does a racehorse, are you making money on them?
So what I have found with racehorses for the most part is, 80% of them are going to break even.
Yeah.
It's the other 20% that you're either going to make a lot or lose a lot. and so, what we found is for the most part, most of our horses looking forward will probably break even. We have 1 or 2 that we're hopeful should make a lot of money.
Interesting.
So it's a little bit different than a lot of other types of investing that we do, where it's kind of like you have your expected value. You're going to make 20% per flip, or you're going to make 12% cash flow every month off a rental. It's not like that. It's really every horse, most horses, you're going to make a couple thousand or lose a couple thousand. And then hopefully that one out of 10 or one out of 20 is going to make you six figures.
One that's winning the Triple Crown.
Or the one that just you buy low and sell high. It breaks out. It's doing a lot better than anybody expected. You make some good decisions on where it runs and what competition it runs against, and then you sell it at the right time. So it's a business I'm still learning, but it's fun, and it's one of those. It's kind of the new challenge. I've done some stuff in the cryptocurrency world, not just investing in cryptocurrency, but actually working with some of the companies that are kind of building blockchain in the technology sector. One of my big things is I don't like investing. I don't like putting money into stuff that I just have to put money in and wait and I don't have control over. I like to do things that I actually have a little bit of control over. So when I decided last year, it was 3 years ago now, that I wanted to get into cryptocurrency, I said, how can I do this but also have some control as opposed to just buying cryptocurrency? And I found a friend of mine who was starting a crypto company, and I kind of got on board with him, and he introduced me to a bunch of other people in the industry. So doing stuff in the crypto world, actually involved in the development side of stuff. We're doing a whole bunch of stuff, and right now we're kind of getting towards, I think, the top of the real estate market, the top of the economic cycle, whether it's a month from now or a year from now or 3 years from now. I think it's clear that we're getting towards the top. So real estate's probably, you can make money at any part of the cycle in real estate, but certainly when you get towards the top, it gets a little bit tougher. So we're slowing down on real estate a little bit. We're focused on different types of real estate ventures. We're not doing as many flips. We're focusing more on buying rental properties, some multifamily stuff. We're doing some lending. And when I say we, it's my wife and myself. We kind of do everything together. We're just kind of doing different stuff. And again, putting family first and trying to be there for every piano recital and every soccer game and just kind of do what we love and figure out how to make money from it.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I love that. I think that's super important, at least for me it is, as well as being able to spend time with your kids. I get my kids on the bus every morning. I get them off the bus.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I love it. It's absolutely great. Some morning it's painful because they don't want to get out of bed.
I had that this morning.
Pretty much every morning for me. My son is 5 and he does not like to, he likes to sleep. Like he can sleep till 10 if you let him.
That's my 8-year-old.
it's great. So what's a favorite book, maybe something you've read kind of recently?
Sure. So I think I could throw out all the same books, I'm guessing, that you've probably heard 1,000 times. I'm going to mention one that for some reason hasn't gotten as popular as I think it should. It's a book called The Goal, G-O-A-L. And the author's name is, Ilya, let's see, I have it right here. It is Eliyahu Goldratt. He's an Israeli guy who basically has written, this book is about the subtitle, it's called The Goal. The subtitle is The Theory of Constraints. And he basically talks about how to optimize and scale a business by eliminating whatever the biggest roadblocks in the business are, whatever the biggest constraints in your business are. And the book, it's basically an allegory. It tells a story, but the whole theme is around identifying those things in your business that are keeping you from scaling. It's the weakest link is the thing that that defines how strong your chain is, or the slowest guy in your group defines how fast you move. Basically identifying where the weakest link in your business is, and then overcoming that obstacle, overcoming that constraint, and basically pushing your business forward and optimizing your business by continually focusing on the weakest part of your business. And it's an amazing book. I think it was written back in the 80s, sold several million copies, but for some reason, so few people in the real estate world and the business world that I talk to have not read this book. So highly recommend it.
Cool. Yeah. I have not read it either. So I'll definitely have to check it out. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Always nice to hear new books. For sure. So a last question before we wrap up, what are your three pillars of wealth creation?
Yeah. So, I think I've talked about all three, but let me summarize. So the first for us is, it's putting family first. And I know that's kind of weird. People say, well, that has nothing to do with business or making money, putting family first. But for us, saying out loud that family comes first, it actually forces us to really think about what we have to do in our business to achieve that. It's easy to say it and not do it, but if we really want to do it, it forces us to define what things in our business can we do to achieve that, what can't we do to achieve that, what types of businesses and what types of things in our business can we do and still achieve that. So it really helps us define what our business is going to be about when we say, hey, our family is always going to come first. It means we can't start a business where I'm going to be traveling for a month at a time. We can't start a business that's going to force me to work on nights and weekends or my wife work on nights and weekends. So defining family first really allows us to define the constraints of our business and businesses. Number two, I think I mentioned as well, I'm a big fan of finding the intersection of what you love and what you can make money from. And a lot of times that intersection isn't big, but it's there. There are things that you enjoy doing that you can make money from. And sometimes you need to really think about it and you need to turn things around and play with things to achieve that. But I look at writing as one of those things. Like I've always loved writing and teaching. I never considered that I could write books and make money writing books. And what I found is that we make well into the six figures on book royalties these days. And it's something I love doing. So for me, it's not really work. So finding the intersection of what you love and what makes you money. And then number three for me is always focus on scaling and optimizing. Because I think too many people spend way too much time working, and I know this is cliche, but working in their business as opposed to on their business. And I see way too many entrepreneurs who say, I want to be my own boss. And then they create a job for themselves. They create something that they can't extract themselves from. If they want to go on vacation for a week, they have to shut the business down because the business can't operate without them. I like to focus on creating businesses that, that not only can operate without me, but because I'm generally a pain in the butt, probably operate better without me and do better without me. So focusing on how you can really pull yourself out of your business and then scale and optimize your business so that you're getting as much out of it, as much income, cash flow, whatever you're trying to get out of it with as little time and as little effort as possible.
Yeah. Cool. I'm looking at I've already got the business, but I'm looking at really growing it. And that's one thing I'm looking at is, if I'm going to grow this, I want to be able to do this without me completely involved in it at all times. You know, sure, there's at the start, I'm going to be more heavily involved, but I want it to be something without, you know, to be able to run without me.
Yep. And you always think of like, what's your exit strategy? And I think for a lot of us, we have one of two exit strategies. One is the business is generating income forever into the future. And I know that for me, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, hopefully I'm not going to want to work at all. But certainly probably a year or two from now, I'm going to want to do something else. And so if I can't extract myself from the business in a year or two from now, I'm either going to be working in a business I don't really feel like being in anymore, or it's not going to be generating nearly as much income for me anymore. Yeah. So if your exit strategy is to have it generate income forever, you need to figure out how that business is going to run without you. The second exit strategy for a lot of us is selling our business. And trust me, nobody wants to buy your business when your business is really you. They're willing to hire you. They might even buy your business with a promise that you're going to work in it for 2 or 5 or 10 years. But you're going to find it hard to really sell and extract yourself from the business if your business can't run without you. So regardless of what your exit strategy is, it's probably going to be better achieved if you figure out how that business can run without you.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate that. Well, last thing, how can people get in touch with you and, buy your books and learn more about you?
So anybody that wants to buy the books, I have 3 books right now, the book on flipping houses, the book on estimating rehab costs, which will teach you how to create scopes of work and estimate how much it's going to cost to do a renovation. And then my newest book, which is the book on negotiating real estate, which for any real estate professional that wants to get better at negotiating deals, both on the buy side and the sell side. That's my latest book, all 3 available on Amazon.com. And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, my email is the letter J at 123flip.com, website's 123flip.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Facebook/J Scott Investor.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Jay, I really appreciate you joining us on the show, taking time out of your day and giving us just a ton of value.
Awesome. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Todd.
Yeah. Have a good rest of the day.
You as well.
Hey, special thanks to Jay Scott for joining us on the show. Appreciate him spending time with us and adding a ton of value. What a great episode. Go back and rewind because there was a ton of value, ton of golden nuggets that he brought to us. So I'm going to mention 3 things that I really took from Jay and what I liked. First of all, he talked about life over work. Make sure you get your life. It's important to work hard and obviously provide for your family and all that kind of stuff, but make sure that you're actually there for that. And that, so life over work. The next thing he talked about is building systems and methodology, making sure that you're creating your business the right way so it can continue to sustain. And so it's got systems. And along with that, the final thing he talked about is to delegate. And of course, without those systems, it's really hard to delegate. Without the methodology, it's really hard to delegate. So, but delegating is extremely important. That's something I need to work on, and I think most of us need to work on, is making sure we're delegating and delegating the right tasks. There's certain tasks that you should be doing, but there's a lot of other tasks that you can give away. And a lot of us, myself included, oftentimes we look at, how much money we'll be giving away if we hire somebody to do something, and we have to decide if it's worth it, which is true. But oftentimes we don't realize that we're actually going to end up making more money because we're able to hire that out and delegate a lot of that work. So I think that's really important for people to be able to realize and to do. So again, awesome. I appreciate Jay Scott for joining us on the show and spending time with us. If you are a first-time listener, first of all, thanks a lot for listening. If you've been listening for a while, definitely appreciate it. I'd love your feedback. If you haven't gone onto iTunes and subscribed, go on iTunes, subscribe, or wherever you're listening and subscribe and give us a rating and review. We'd love to hear what you're thinking about the show, what you like. And also you can make comments to us on our Facebook page. So it's just Pillars of Wealth Creation or Pillars of Wealth on Facebook. You can also make comments on YouTube and let us know what you want to get out of these shows. Maybe you'd like me to ask different questions. Maybe you've got something that you really want answered. Just let us know that. We'd love to answer questions. We'd love to have dialogue with our listeners. So reach out to us and help us and just be a part of this community. I am Todd Dykstrammer. I'm signing out. Make every day a Saturday. Are you ready to start investing in real estate today but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy-to-understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars. To claim your free course today.